Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy, and I'm here with Managing Editor and good friend Richard Hill. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Matt. Here I am in steamy and sweltering Sydney, which, yes, we've got lots of rain and lots of heat, so that's a lot of fun.
Yes, yes, and we're in very temperate, cool Queensland, which is quite weird.
Yes, well, the plants love it and the ducks are loving it. But I've got a friend of mine who sent a picture from Chicago, and there's a garden ornament, a large, tall garden, and all you can see is the top of the head above the snow. So the world is always this wondrous different place this time of year.
Now, Richard, it's the beginning of February and we have been absent for a month.
We've been a bit quiet for a month. I mean, we have been busy, but that's right. We've had to reduce some of our activities because we're in the last month of activity with our book for Nordens, which is very good.
It is. And for anyone that's written a book, you'll know they're sort of the struggle.
Yeah, yes, that wonderful last month where you say, oh, my God, I should have written more in March last year. But, so this will be our book will come out. And the sort of working title is The Practitioner's Guide to the Science of Psychotherapy. So we have lots of different chapters. We discuss a couple of things today. But anyway, that's a longer-term thing. What else is happening, Matt?
Yeah, so at the end of the last year, we did a survey to everybody that's on our mailing list, and we got some great responses, and people told us, you know, what they would like to see more of in 2021. So we're making some moves to do that.
Yes, it's like good relational work. If you want to find out what someone thinks, it's a really nice idea to ask them. And it's also a really nice idea to respond. So we are grateful for the response, because I know we get these. I get them all the time, you know, answer this survey, do that. But they've said some great stuff. You know, they love the magazine, so we will keep ploughing away at that, and there's some great material coming in. And certainly invitation from the managing editor to anybody who wants to submit something, even just an idea, please do email me about that. And they also love our podcasts, which is really good. That's what we're doing now. We've been on a bit of a hiatus, but we're back in the swing. What else was there?
There was also our learning materials, so our courses and just a general sort of material that we have available to our subscribers. People love that. And in research news, you know, the latest news about what's happening in science in general, neuroscience, it's applicable to psychotherapy.
Which is something that we're going to talk a little bit about on some of our own research. But one of the interesting comments about the Academy and our resource material, people are saying, you know, I'm having a bit of trouble navigating what's around. And it always is difficult, and you go to different sites and see different things. But we had a listen, you certainly had a listen, because you're the genius in this, and you've done a really major rethink. I'm loving it.
Yeah. So what we've done, and also inspired by the book that we're writing as well, I've done is brought everything together into six sort of packages. I've called them core resources. So we've bundled everything together. And so we've got brain fundamentals in one sort of package, the body and the brain in another package. We've got genetics, we've got disorders, clinical applications, and then other science in the sixth package. So if you go to our .net website, and you will see that we've got these sort of six categories, you can dive in there and all of the material is there.
And I tell you what, you click on those categories, it's like walking into the TARDIS. It's a marvelous experience. But you just have to go through a very small set of doors rather than having everything. It was a bit difficult, but now it's really beautiful.
I have to admit, yes, it was difficult to navigate in the past, and I'm hoping for our standard subscribers that, you know, this is the thing that will help you, you know, have access in an easy way to all of the resources that we have.
Oh, and one quick thing, sorry, Matt, before with the standard subscribers and with our Academy, now I'm not sure how many of you have taken an interest in the Mirroring Hands course, some of our subscribers, but saying, oh, like, I don't really want to, you know, it's an additional cost and so on and so forth. We've now reached a point where we're able to now include the Mirroring Hands course, which of course talks about the Mirroring Hands practice, but it's talking about systems. It's talking about client responsiveness. It's talking about the techniques and the technology and the academic framework behind things. Anyway, that's now in the Academy. So if you're a subscriber, you can now jump in and use that and access that now. If on, also you're someone who's interested in the course, but you know you want to get your money's worth, now you can subscribe. You'll get that course and you'll also get all the science of psychotherapy. So if you're sort of interested in that hypnotherapy but from a science point of view, anyway, I'm really pleased to have done that. We did very nicely out of its exposure, but now we make it much more generally available, which is great.
That's right. We're aiming to provide our standard subscribers with as much content as possible. Look, in a year's worth of your subscription, I very much doubt that you would be able to even read all of the last 8 years of content that we have available to you.
Yeah, and the videos and there's message. There's 2 or 3 years worth of activity for which you will get on a very large number of them certificates that you can utilize for continuing education points.
All right. Brilliant. Okay.
That's the primary of that. What else are we doing?
So from the survey, people want to know more about some research news. So, Richard, you've been looking into a few things.
Okay. Well, here we are. Again, as you put so nicely, we're going to be able to utilize our book as a sort of a framework. It gives us our core competencies. And as you know, and I think a lot of people know, genetics is something that I'm extremely interested in. Ernie Rossi, my beautiful late mentor, got me into doing this and has made me study this for the last 10 years. I get stuff coming into my emails. And so there was one that came in that was fairly recent talking about polymorphisms in some of our genetic makeup that give you negative and positive dispositions to depression, to stress, to dealing with various processes. I'll give the detail in a moment. But what it also did was when I opened that, it then started this search engine, Academia, it's called, sent me all kinds of ones. Oh, you opened that one, you might be interested in this one. So I got a whole swag of these research papers spanning over the last decade. And what these guys were looking at was in particular BDNF, the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is John Rady, who called it brain juice.
That's great.
The beautiful thing. And also serotonin and the effects of that. So you've got the 5-HTT. So you have the serotonin itself and the 5-HTTR, the receptor. All these things are really important in giving some indicator. They're talking about the ability to use these as biomarkers. Let me just have a quick look at something we've got here. This epigenetic alterations related to early life stressful events. Now, we're all familiar with the ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experiences model, which gives us a behavioral, it's actually a form you can fill out based on experiential elements. Now, it is possible to look in and have a look at what's going on in the DNA. Now, we have epigenetics, which can be turning on and off.
Yep.
We have mutations, what we call polymorphisms, where there is a change in one of the nucleotides or a group of nucleotides. And for those who are into this stuff, they'll understand what Val66 MET means. So it's valine, the 66 chromosome, and the methionine. So you can have these particular polymorphisms or single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, that are able to be explored and examined and seen when you do a genetic test, which give you an indication of the potential or the disposition that this character, this persona has.
I think that's an important point, isn't it? This is just potential or disposition.
Which is exactly, you're right. The important thing is nothing means you are stuck. You are stuck. It's not linear. But what it does is that of the options, of the type of emergent possibilities, someone with a particular mechanism that closes down or shuts off the appropriate receptivity to serotonin or availability of serotonin, or the receptivity or availability of BDNF, then what they're going to do is have a different time than the usual in order to manage.
Yep.
Or they may have a difficult time compared to the usual because they're trying to manage in the same way everybody else is managing.
Yeah.
And it gives you a unique aspect. You are more sensitive than this other person. So respond more boldly. Respond and learn more responses. This is right. The response ability. And, I mean, there's a lovely set, and I'll just finish off with this last couple of things and then we'll go on to yours. I mean, here's some papers looking at the an analysis of the encoding of the serotonin transporter and the dopamine transporter and BDNF, and this is from a group in Brazil. And then we've got here the epigenetic modulation in mood disorders. This is a group in Sweden. And then we have in the Journal of Affective Disorders talking about negative affectivity moderated by BDNF and stress responses by a group in Colombia. What's important is to look at these papers from all around the world that give you a sense of different cultures, different environments, elements of early childhood experiences. There are things that happen, I don't know, in Colombia that may bother someone in Sweden, but and vice versa. And one of the ones that I like to follow whenever I see them come up is just this indicator of increased susceptibility to suicidal behavior. There's quite a lot, and this is a really interesting one that comes from Italy.
Okay. Right.
So there's a lot of work. There's a lot of international work, which is very relevant. Do please look it up. But have a look at these things. Now, BDNF and serotonin are not the only ones. They're the ones that these papers are looking at. So let's not get caught up in that, oh, that's the evidence because we've got the most evidence in that one. Look at that one. We've got a lot of evidence. I wonder what else there is.
Yeah. Can I get you to speculate on where this research is taking us in terms of clinical practice and psychotherapy? So we might be able to, you know, screen and understand what is the potential for someone.
If we can get therapists to behave in a responsive way rather than a reactive way, meaning that they get some information and put that into the complex self-organizing soup rather than saying, I know what's wrong with you.
Right.
Then as we're now moving towards the ability to have very quick time to read the DNA, there's a word for that, to have a look at the genotype.
Yep.
And then we can compare it to our observed, what we call the phenotype, the thing we see, the behavior and the aspects and things we can see. If that can increase our understanding of that person, say, well, this person's always reacting this way. And you go, oh, well, look, you see, your brother's not got this polymorphism, but you do have this polymorphism. So you and your brother shouldn't be dealing with trying to deal with things exactly the same way. Should have some variation. And the other one is to give you some awareness of the potential of someone. Okay. We do this observationally. If someone comes in and they're limping, then we go, oh, this probably indicates that there's something I need to know about their legs. I need to know about their movement. So it doesn't mean saying, oh, they're limping, they're bad, they're this or just. There's an avenue of exploration that is open to me.
Okay, wow. So a genetic profile may be part of the toolkit for future psychotherapists.
Yeah, not sort of your Gattaca, if anyone's seen that film, where everybody then is parceled off and given permission or not given permission based on the genetics. But it gives you the individual, just as we should do. There's a chat today on a pedagogy site talking about styles of education and types of, you know, we have musical or visual or oral and saying there's no evidence to all this. But there is, I think, experiential evidence that on different days we have different perceptions and inclinations and receptivities. And that is the sensitivity that we can add. And as DNA becomes almost real time, and you know, when we get it down to $20 a go, we can really utilize this to see not only what is potential, but also what we need to look for. And what we're doing, sort of, oh, wow, we've just did that treatment and we looked at their DNA profile and their anti-inflammatory genes turned on. Wow, that's great. Or we've just done that process. They didn't look too good. Here's their genes. Oh, my God, we've tripped up their cortisol and we've got, they've got this polymorphism. Oh, we never saw that. So these things can be useful in adding, not dominating or controlling or overriding, but adding to your depth of sensitivity. Your knowledge is about sensitivity.
Wow, what an exciting frontier this all is.
Now,
another exciting frontier, I've only just had a look at this paper from Frontiers in Physiology, in their Fractal and Network Physiology set of papers. And this one, the title is Linking ADHD and Behavioral Assessment Through Identification of Sharing Diagnostic Task-Based Functional Connections. Which is
I love the academic titles. You know, goodness gracious me. But I kind of get in there. But what's that saying to me?
So in essence, what they're doing is they're using machine learning, so deep neural networks, so using machine learning to understand the connectivity between different brain regions that give us a bit of a signature, well, not a bit of a signature, giving us a signature of ADHD, and in a way that is non-linear. So, you know, we're familiar with a linear way of looking at connectivity. So the prefrontal cortex has some sort of control over the default mode network, i.e. turning it down so that we can focus. We've talked about the default mode in the past. That's kind of the state where we're sort of daydreamy and we're not really on task. The prefrontal cortex can suppress that activity of the default mode so that we can be task orientated, we can pay attention to something. Now, that's a very simple linear sort of understanding of one part of the brain's neural connectivity that might be able to explain a little bit of ADHD, where there's a failure of suppressing the default mode.
So this is interesting. So what I'm hearing, so instead of what we're doing, which a lot of people have said very clunky, you know, like this part lights up and that part light up. We're actually looking at this connectome type of idea of patterns in the sort of patterns in the neural activity, and that they've sort of been able to show that there are indicators there of certain things, and this one ADHD. Is that what we're getting at?
Yes. So we're looking at nonlinear relationships. So if
relationships, yeah.
If A, like brain region A plus activation of brain region B equals, you know, some sort of behavior, that's a linear relationship. Right. But if A plus B plus C then prevents the A plus B.
Yeah. And I'm getting what you mean, because actually what this is doing, because literally we're talking about A plus B plus C plus D plus E plus S plus D. because this is what you were saying when we were talking about it before, there's too much for us to actually observe. We really need computers, some kind of algorithm, to read the huge complexity, to get some insight into the huge complexity. And this is, wow. So where you, this is this brain to technology interface.
It is. It's very exciting work, this. We're using these deep neural networks, and they can identify some very complex relationships that we would have, we would struggle to make the connections ourselves. And so these guys that have done this study, and I'll put this study in the show notes so that you can go and have a look, because they're claiming that they've got a 99% accuracy in identifying ADHD in children, but also in adults. So a child that's been diagnosed with ADHD, when they're an adult, it seems that these machine learning algorithms can pick up that the underlying connectivity is still there. Even though the adult brain has matured, there's probably more integration, the adult has probably learned a lot of skills, right, to be able to pay attention. And yet these algorithms are able to identify with 99% accuracy that there's still an underlying connectivity there. And it's not a straightforward linear connectivity. So there might be an typical ADHD pattern, but there might also be an atypical pattern, which looks a bit different, like there's different parts that are lighting up and incoherence in the brain, and yet it's manifesting the same symptoms of ADHD.
Yeah, this is ramping up. I'm thinking of Daniel Amen's work where he did the spectrography and stuff. Mm-hmm. So this is actually a ramp up from that. And it excites me because I always look at all these what people call conditions as a negative thing. There's an ADD or an ADHD type of brain that operates in a certain functional way. And all you have to do is just utilize that way in which that brain activates in order to maximize activity. And I had the great opportunity and good fortune, my stepson, who I met, oh gosh, it's 15, 16 years ago now, and we've been working together, not as an overt psychotherapy type of practice or things, but we've been working cooperatively and co-regulatorily. And the principal mechanism that I utilized in order to give him the best activation of his ADHD brain so it didn't turn off and do these things was curiosity.
Right.
And he was the first experiment in the benefits of the curiosity altered mind state, which led, of course, to the nunchus nuclei and the understanding of all those bits and pieces. And when his prefrontal cortex starts to shut down, which I'm sure this algorithm is picking up these sorts of potential patterns, it was curiosity that enabled my dear stepson to turn his prefrontal cortex back on, or at least, so instead of using methamphetamine, which is always a bit of a trick, he used the quote marks amphetamine of curiosity. So the norepinephrine and the acetylcholine and the attention doings. And it's been enormously effective. And he went from someone who couldn't really hold down a job as to being now one of our revered restoration plasterers of Victorian properties. And he is not like some bright-eyed, bubbly guy. He's got this very particular persona, but we've applied it through curiosity to producing the work, and he's brilliant. He's just brilliant.
Yeah. And so part of what curiosity may be doing is allowing the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex to downregulate some parts of the default mode network, and it's giving that extra neural activity.
That's right. And it's the increase in norepinephrine and acetylcholine in the context of focus and of attention that activates the dorsolateral, which is important for thinking, but also the ventrolateral and the orbitofrontal, which is bringing in those emotional stabilities. Because, of course, that's the thing where, ADHD freak out, or as Pete did, he would go to sleep. And also the orbitofrontal, which is picking up for error detection. And so it's going, no, this is not wrong. You are not, this is not a bad thing. This is an okay thing, and proceed forward. So and that's what happens to us all naturally. But and someone with an ADD inclined brain, here's this thing. You've got this indication of this is how you're going to need to spark yourself up.
So the point of the study for me is just the power of machine learning now for diagnostic purposes. So just like you were saying with genetics and being able to identify potentials that are in people's genetics, I mean, here we have potentials or actual things that are happening in people's connectivity in their brain. And then what do we do with that as therapists? Well, it informs us, doesn't it? And like you said, then we can be more sensitive in our approach.
It's utilizing rather than gaining additional controls and reasons to dominate. That's of course a story that we keep plugging. But here's the information, and as I always say, that's interesting. What's that all about? And what can I create with that?
Absolutely. Okay, that's great. So We'll put links in the show notes to all those studies so people can have a better look. Now, Richard, we've got a February issue of The Science of Psychotherapy is out. Who do we have in that?
Oh, good. Okay. Well, it's probably time to wind up soon, so let's have a quick look at that. Yep. So we've got a beautiful excerpt from a new book edited by Dan Siegel and Marion Solomon. And we've got a chapter from Jack and Trudy Cornfield. I was actually at the lecture that they delivered that this is a transcript from, and it was just a fantastic experience. Terry Marks-Tarlow we're celebrating her work with her colleagues on fractals, and we've got another excerpt talking about fractals. I mean, we've had some things, but sometimes people have said, yeah, but I don't understand it enough. So this is really great, but it's also celebrating the fact that their fabulous book has gone, and we'll have that in the magazine, has gone to paperback, and they've been put up for an award. Now, Gunnel Millett, who is our wonderful book reviewer, has got a fantastic book on this extraordinary look into the brain. Go look at that. And we've got the start of a series of last words, and it's basically I'm trying to pull together views of psychotherapy around the world. We're starting off with a very interesting fellow named Richard Lakeman from Australia, and he's actually teaching mental health nursing. He teaches to that, and he's got lots of great stuff. He's out at Southern Cross Uni, and he's talking about the he might think that psychotherapy is in a bit of a parlous state in Australia. So he's looking at that. Next month, you know, I've got something from John Arden, and then we're sending out inquiries to our friends in various places. I've got friends in Sweden, and of course we have friends in Egypt, and so we'll be looking at this all around the world as best we can.
Okay, fantastic. So look out for that one. Well, that will be out by the time this podcast is released. That February issue will be out, so grab hold of that. Well, Richard, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, I've said enough words to I've settled down, Richard, and I'm not ADHD.
You're just making up for the month that we've been silent.
Yes, that's everything I haven't said for a month. No, brilliant. But great to be back. Great to chat again about these things, and we look forward to lots of fabulous guests over the coming weeks.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, everybody, for dropping in and listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. And we hope you'll join us in the weeks to come. Bye for now.
And bye for me.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.